Ready for commandment number 6. But last night we covered 3 and admittedly with a little bit of speed, but tried to get some thoughts out of them. The concept of not taking the Lord's name in vain, the concept of keeping the Sabbath, and the concept of honoring our parents we touched on a little bit toward the end. Does anybody have a comment, a question, or an additional thought they'd like to share with us on anything we've discussed, but in particular, something we might have talked about last night that has occurred to you that we didn't cover or you'd like to try to have somebody address or would be of edification to us? Several people have asked me for copies of the overheads, so I just didn't think anybody really want them, to be honest with you. It just didn't really occur to me. But I'm going to make at least 3 sets and give Marla a set and Bobby a set and leave a set. Okay, leave a set with someone here at Pleasant Hill. I'll leave it with Nora Lee. And then if you want a set, see them and they'll get you a set made or something like that. Because I really don't know how many sets people want. There may be 10 or there may be 30. So that's kind of what I agreed to do last night, and be happy to do that.
John, would you do that with the Ten Commandments song too?
Yes, I will. Okay. Okay. Yeah, I had never run onto a Ten Commandments song, so I had to do a little bit of digging. I didn't write that myself.
I thought you did.
No, I didn't. A lady in Topeka had that, so I kind of lucked out. You can write them, but they're not hard to write.
Just sing it on the tape.
I think you'd do better if I give you the words, David. No one would want to sing it. I've heard myself sing, so I can't be deluded in that area. Okay, number 6. Thou shalt not kill. This is an interesting commandment. Probably, in actuality, an appropriate translation of it would be thou shalt not murder. But the concept of killing and murder have some real similarities. I find this a real interesting one, and I'll try not to overspend time on it, but I think it's got a lot of social implications for us today. Not that we're a collection of serial mass murderers, but you get into some interesting areas like euthanasia and abortion. I'm not going to dwell on those in a great deal, but depending upon your particular beliefs, this could have a bearing on those. And we won't run from those topics. I'll be happy to comment on them. I've got one of them already on one of my slides. The Hebrew word for kill here is, I would pronounce it rashuk. If you really wanted to be crude, you could call it rat chaff. But it really means to kill, but with a special emphasis on to murder. And I believe this particular commandment is the concept of the sanctity of human life. That's the concept that God's trying to get across to the children of Israel and for those that lived under this particular dispensation. But as we talked Monday night, I don't believe this is a new principle. He was getting this across to Cain after he killed Abel. And Cain must have known that to do what he did was wrong, and somehow God held him accountable. I just don't believe God would hold an individual accountable for an action if he had not previously had an opportunity to know that it was against God's will. That doesn't seem to be a just God. Whether it was by revelation, whether it was by conscience, I can't tell you because the Bible doesn't tell us. But I'm persuaded that mankind from the get-go knew that taking the life of another individual in an unauthorized manner was wrong. And that's what this is talking about. Taking the life of another individual in an unauthorized manner. And we'll talk in a little bit about what might be an authorized manner versus an unauthorized manner. The concept, the reason I believe the sanctity of human life is that is in essence when that individual's opportunity for salvation ends. If you believe the Bible like I believe the Bible, it's at the end of an individual's life that he has his last chance to become a child of God. And if he hasn't taken advantage of it by that time, there simply is no second chance. There are religions, there are predominant religions that do foster the concept of that second chance, but I can't find it, and I doubt you can, substantiate it in the Bible. And that's what makes killing an individual such a tremendously important thing, because you are taking, if you kill someone, you take that person's last chance at being saved away from them. If they're not a Christian at that moment, then Christianity has eluded them. So it's not a small feat, no matter how we might glamorize it in our paperback novels and in our Saturday afternoon westerns. And I don't have a hang up on those. I enjoy the action-packed things probably as much as anybody. But there is a tendency sometimes to make life a little bit less solemn than God intended it. If you've got your Bibles, I think it's an important enough passage, and we're going to run into it several times. Take a look at Genesis chapter 9. If there was any doubt that under the patriarchal dispensation, taking one's life was an inappropriate thing to do, this ought to clear it up. And I believe, as I told you, even in the ages of Adam and Eve with Cain and Abel. But in Genesis chapter 9, verses 5 and 6, this is right after, as the earth's being repopulated after the flood, "And surely your blood of your lives will I require, at the hand of every beast will I require it, at the hand of man, at the hand of every man's brother will I require the life of man. Whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God made he him." I believe that's a clear designation that killing is wrong, and that someone that entertains killing, the powers that be, in this case the next of kin, the powers that be have every right to take that man's life as a punishment for it. And it also in these verses gives us a reason for this severe penalty. It's because he made us, the end of verse 6, "For in the image of God made he man." The reason your life is so sacred to God is that you are made in the image of God. And I am made in the image of God. I find nowhere in the Scriptures where this edict or this teaching is rescinded. And I believe that because we're still in the image of man, image of God. We're still made in God's image. If mankind was no longer made in God's image, then I might be able to accept that this particular principle was not in effect. But I do believe this particular principle remains in effect. The blood or life is sacred and is to be viewed accordingly. You remember in Acts chapter 15, verse 29. Acts 15 is where they had the Jerusalem Council. And they brought, Paul came down and they met with some of the brethren at Jerusalem. And remember two of the things that they said they were going to abstain from. One of them was the drinking of blood, and the other one was from things that have been strangled. And I think those two tie very closely together, because strangulation tends to leave the blood in the body to an excessive period. And he's trying to stress the sanctity of blood. Well, you don't have to go very deep into Christian theology to see the importance of blood, or Judaistic theology. The sprinkling of blood on the mercy seat during the days of atonement that the high priest did once a year, the shedding of Christ's blood. Blood has always had a special place in God's redemptive scheme, and he takes it extremely seriously. And anybody that sheds it, God gives life, and I believe that only he can authorize the taking of it. I believe in Genesis chapter 9, verse 6, 5 and 6, he did give us an instance where life could be taken in an authorized fashion. And when I say in an authorized fashion, that means that I'm saying I believe God has told man that under these circumstances he has the right to take a life. Doesn't mean he wants to or should enjoy it or anything, but it's simply a punishment that God has instituted. I'll go down just a little bit further, then I'll stop for any comments you might have before I go further. I believe that murder is a sin, and it's a defilement not simply against the person that's killed. It's also a defilement against God, because you are made in God's image. Even though we don't act like it, we are, because he said we were. So when one kills another, you are in actuality defiling, in almost a blasphemous way, an image of God. And that's something that God takes extremely seriously. And yet murderers are to be killed by man, but as I've indicated, only by God's authorization. This last paragraph that I put up there is one of the counter-arguments that is made against killing under any circumstances. And this is an argument that's held by some people that I hold in extremely high esteem. It may be an argument that's held by some people here, and I'm not going to make it a test of our ability to worship together, but I thought I'd present it to you, and then I'll tell you why it doesn't ring for me, at least at this stage in my life. The argument is, can you imagine that Christ would ever kill someone under any circumstances? And if you answer that with a no, then how could we, if we're to be in the image of Christ, ever kill under any circumstances? But usually people in the church that take that position, I have found, also believe that capital punishment is okay as long as it's executed by the civil government. And that's where, for me, it breaks down, because that puts us in a position of saying we believe in something as long as someone else will do our dirty work. And that just doesn't quite ring true for me. It may be because I'm not sharp enough to see it. It just seems like if something is true, even though I wouldn't want to do it, if I believe in capital punishment, for instance, I should be willing to do it if that were my job. Doesn't mean I would want to do it, but it would seem to me like that would be an area. So some of you may take this position, and I will accept the concept. It's hard to grasp of Christ killing a man under any circumstances, because Christ is love, but God killed people. And if God, the Father, would kill people, even though it's hard for our minds to grasp it, it seems to me not to be a theological problem for me to imagine that Christ would, under certain circumstances, kill people. Christ is going to come back and someday send people to eternal damnation. That's far more serious than the extinguishing of a physical life. So I understand the difficulty of visualizing Christ shooting somebody or stoning somebody, but it doesn't theologically hold for me. Would anyone like to make a comment on any of the things that I've covered, or anything on this topic? We're not leaving this topic, but anything that we've covered so far.
I don't want to throw you a curve, John.
Sure you do.
How do you feel about those of us who have served in the military, and possibly some of us here have taken another person's life?
Okay, I'll be happy to answer that about halfway down this slide. I had intended to, so if I don't answer it to your satisfaction, then come right back at me, because that's an important... And this is a good time to talk about those things, because we as a nation are not at war. When I was growing up, it was Vietnam, and even the most objective person in the world couldn't discuss that thing objectively. Because, well, if you were my age, because if you had a high lottery number, you had one position, and if you had a low lottery number, you had another position. And it wasn't quite that simple, but emotions and reality, you know, happened to set in. So since we're not at war, it's a good time to talk about it a little more objectively. I've listed now 6 different ways in which I think a person can be killed, and then I thought we'd just take a few moments to discuss the religious ramifications as I see them, and I'd like to get your input also. A person can be killed accidentally, and I believe an accident is just that. It's an accident. It's terrible. It's tragic. In the Old Testament, there were places that's called cities of refuge that you're well aware of that people could go to get a fair trial, a fair hearing, and if they had done it as an accident, then they were allowed to live. If it was found to have been intentional, then revenge was executed. So I think an accidental killing is just that. It's a killing that's a tragedy. It happens. Oftentimes nobody feels any worse than the person that was involved in it. But I don't think God holds us accountable for things that are beyond our control. Now, accidents can happen due to negligence, and that might be a slightly different issue that you'd have to consider. This next one gets real interesting, because I think suicide also comes under the heading of thou shalt not kill, because more people probably kill themselves than kill other people. I personally have known, let me phrase it that way, more people who have killed themselves than have killed someone else. It's interesting. I have found 6 cases of suicide in the Bible. I won't say there's no more than 6, but I will say I've not found more than 6. And I've listed them up here just for your interest. 5 of them are in the Old Testament, and 1 of them is in the New Testament. Ahithophel, one of the advisors of Absalom, killed himself. Zimri killed himself. Abimelech killed himself. Samson, I believe, killed himself, pulled the palace down on him. Saul fell on his own sword, and Judas. Now, having said that, there's at least 6 cases of suicide in the Bible. None of those really give me a clear indication of whether God thinks suicide is right or wrong. It really is not editorialized on a great deal. It's stated more as a case of fact. And you might have opinions on some of them. You're probably more familiar with the last 3 than you are the first 3. You might want to go back and study them. This is my position on it, and it's open for discussion. I believe suicide, when it's an unauthorized taking of life, is not right. Suicide, like homicide, follows the same rules for me. I put Samson down there as a question mark because I could make a case for 5 of them being unauthorized. Samson may have been an authorized suicide because he prayed to God that he would have strength to pull down those pillars. God gave him that strength, and he did. So that may have been an act of war. That may have been an authorized suicide. I can't judge that. The others don't appear to me, from what I know from the scriptures, of being authorized. And I personally apply the same rules with this asterisk. It seems to me like sometimes suicide can be due to cowardice, simply not wanting to face life. And I'm sure sometimes suicide is due to a mental illness. And it would seem logical for me that God would view those 2 motivations differently and would take into account a mental illness that might have led someone to a suicide that no one even knew they had. So when it all comes boiling down, people that committed suicide, I've got to leave that to God because He knows whether which one of these or if it was another scenario. And I just can't judge. But it seems to me like If it's a cowardice, not wanting to live, and doesn't have any extenuating mental illnesses, then it could be an unauthorized taking of life. Some will argue that all suicides are due to mental illness. I don't personally believe that, but we could stay here till 12 o'clock and bat that one back and forth, and the ball would still be somewhere in the air, and we'd probably still have our own beliefs. So. Many of us, I know I have, my first brush with suicide was in my senior year in high school when one of my classmates hung himself. And, you know, you can recount the stories. And a member at our church when I was growing up shot, you know. I'm not trying to get morbid, it just brushes our lives closer than we realize. God will have to sort out the motivations for that. Does anybody have a comment on that concept, Clark? Okay, it's probably not the only thing.
It's because I can understand if a person does something that he knows is going to cause his death.
Mm-hmm.
That's the same as suicide because he has somebody else to do it. But suicide to do that. You even heard it in the army. You had it in World War II, I think you had it in the Korean War. They talk about suicide hill.
Yeah.
Great idea. Say Jesus Christ that way. He knew what was going to happen to him by the acts that he was taking.
Mm-hmm.
And Stephen, for the very thing that he was doing also, he knew he was going to get killed.
Yeah, the difference I would see in those last 2 is, as I believe, that if we give our life for the cause of Christ, that's an authorized giving of our life. That would be the way I would look. Yes. Now, just to go out and get killed so I can be martyred, I'm not saying that's right, but if I'm doing it in my attempts to be an honest, sincere Christian, I believe that's different. Clifford?
I had a student that lost both legs and an arm, and he was
Yep.
World War II is a combat. You took a piece of reality, I mean, a piece of retail. I can't even think of the word.
Land.
You take a piece of land, you held it.
Sure. Well, each war is different, but to see inside a person's mind as to why they do or don't do something, I got enough trouble trying to get inside my own mind without trying to get inside other people's mind. So I'm willing to let God sort that out. One more, then we'll move. Jerry?
Now, there is a passage of Scripture in the New Testament that says, greater love have no man than this, and a man lays down his life for his friend.
That's right. That's right. I don't think a parent who runs out in front of a car and pushes their child aside so that the child can live and the parent's killed, I don't think that's suicide. And even if I thought it was suicide, that verse would indicate to me it's authorized in that case, but I don't consider that suicide.
I don't think that would be a dictionary or a scripture definition of suicide. In Christ giving himself, that was not suicide. We think of suicide as an intentional self-inflicted death.
Okay, let's talk just a little bit about capital punishment. I've already touched on my feelings on that. I believe Genesis chapter 9, verse 6 authorizes capital punishment, the taking of a life for the taking of a life. And I don't know of any place in the Scriptures that principle's ever been repealed. You can debate whether it's a deterrent or whether it's not, but I believe that concept is still in place because we're still in the image of God. Now, I do believe it's a little different than it was in Genesis, because in Genesis it says that man's blood shall be taken by his brother or his next of kin. And I would submit that Romans 13 and 4 transfers that to the civil government to exercise, where it says the government will, it says it will not, they will not bear the sword in vain. Okay? Sometimes it's hard for us to understand the workings of government because government is just a collection of people. But I do believe that authority has been transferred to the civil government. Therefore, as a Christian, if I believe in capital punishment, which I do, then although it would not be my desire to have the job, I should, I believe, be willing to throw the switch. I don't know that I would be willing to throw the switch, but I'm just saying intellectually, if I believe in it, I'm just not comfortable saying I believe in this, but I want someone else to do my dirty work for me that I'm not willing to do. Yeah, Mark. I would say both.
The verbiage in your language says, "Thy man shall
not be shared." Yeah. No, I believe it authorizes it, and I believe that's God's intent.
So what do you do in the example where the person has clearly been proven to have committed the act, but for one reason or another is absolved of the crime?
Well, I believe that's... That even if I might believe that's erroneous, Mark, I believe that's within the jurisdiction of the civil government to be erroneous. I don't agree with everything the civil government does, but if the civil government's error is not inhibiting me from worshiping God like I believe, then I leave that to them and let God judge the civil government. That's my answer. Steve.
John, I got to ask you this question.
Shoot. Okay.
I'm applying the same rule you used back there.
Okay.
You said that if a murderer killed someone, took their life, and they were a non-Christian, part of the reason would be the fact that they would not have the chance to become a Christian later. Wouldn't we run into the same problem with capital punishment if we took someone's life that might possibly...
Yes. Well, you would, except I believe in the case of capital punishment, God has authorized it. And in the case of murder, God has not authorized it. Now, if you're asking me why God authorized one and didn't authorize the other, you know, my mind doesn't grasp all of what God says. I believe it has to do with the sanctity of it, but I believe the seriousness of taking a life is because you don't have that opportunity for salvation. But God, I believe overriding that is God's authorization of capital punishment. Hello. You know, if I understand the cities of refuge, it gave them a place to go to have a fair hearing.
Right.
But if they did the killing intentionally, then the execution of the punishment was swift.
We still could have high priest died.
Yeah. But I don't think the cities of refuge was so much. I mean, if you killed a man intentionally and then you ran there and said, "I'm sorry," I don't think that was the issue. It was simply a place to go to make sure you wouldn't be vengeance wouldn't get you before you had a chance to have a fair hearing. And it was really to protect the people who did it out of accident rather than to protect the people that did it out of thought or provocation. Okay, I understand that, and I believe that there's a point there. Someone that murders and goes to jail and awaits trial, he could enter into a repentance, even though he might have to give his life by the law of the land for that. He could still possibly get himself in a right relationship with God. Okay, I didn't understand your point. If I understand your point now, I think it's a good one. Thank you. Vern.
The strong point to me here is the fact that the murderer has far more
himself and
get himself corrected than a guy that they murdered.
Sure.
He has no chance at all. Sure. That's true. Something I'd like to point out is not exactly on this here taking life or not. This country is deteriorating rapidly because of increasing crime or lawlessness of all kinds. Well, Clifford, I don't disagree with what you're saying, but external restraints to change an internal problem is often not very successful. Okay, let me move here without going too much further in that, because I am going to get in a time crunch tomorrow night if I don't move a little bit. This was the one that Vern brought up, the concept of war. That's a hard one for me. I believe God gives us the right to defend ourselves. Therefore, if a war is to defend ourselves, then I don't have too much of a problem with that. If a war, on the other hand, is born out of greed for a country to expand and to get more wealth and more greed, then that becomes more difficult for me. I'll be quite honest. The passages that say that you're to honor your civil government and not rebel against it. Well, how did God view the American Revolution? I'm not sure. I mean, I know how I want to answer that, but that was a rebellion against the civil government. So, you've almost got to look at each war. The problem is we as citizens usually don't have enough facts and can't really tell what's really going on to make those judgments. So you have to pray about it and make the judgments. I have no critique of anyone that served in the war serving their country. I have a great amount of admonition for you. So you'll get no condemnation from me because I think you did the best you could with the information you had. But I think it's a tough one. I don't think you should lay awake night worrying about it if you made the best judgment you could with the information that you had. Intellectually, I believe a defensive war is appropriate and an aggressive war is not. The difficulty is lots of wars are a combination of those two. Okay. Self-defense. This ties into it just a little bit. But this I had in mind. The thief's coming into your house. You've got a handgun. What do you do? Blow him away or what? Well,
again, I do believe you have the right for self-defense, but I think being a Christian, killing someone out of self-defense should be our last resort. And I've never had to face this, so, you know, I can tell you what I would want to do till I'm blue in the face, and until I had to do it, I can't be sure. But I would think, like to think, I would like to slow him down and stop him by shooting him in the leg or somewhere other than taking his life. He's got a gun pointed out at me, and I'm convinced it's me or him. I think in good conscience I probably could, and to protect my family. And I would not be critical of anyone that did that, but I would like to think that would be a last resort, because taking of life is such a finality of its act. And many people I have high respect for are conscientious objectors. And I respect them more than I did 20 years ago, to be honest with you. I see more validity to their argument. But I believe it's right. Euthanasia, I put that up there. Not that I want to get into a long harangue, but this is going to be something that will be a social decision for us more and more. The putting of ourselves or relatives, keeping them alive on various life support systems. I believe death is God's call, not mine. And when God wants to take you and he wants to take me, then so be it. And I would only caution, let's be careful about artificially preserving the body when God's already called that one to be back with him. And I think most of us feel that way about ourselves. But when it's a relative, it's a hard thing for us to let go of them. I don't believe in mercy killings and taking the life of an individual who still has the ability to sustain life on their own. I just believe that's God's call, not ours. And would be very uncomfortable doing that. Norley?
How do you feel about donating organ parts?
I have no problem at all with the donation of organ parts, because I think the parts of the body are irrelevant to God. It's the soul and the spirit that are relevant to God. And I have no problem with it at all. Huh? Helps a lot of people. And let's not just think about this. Let's not discuss this point. I will lay it out. Someday they're going to do a brain transplant. And then I don't know. I'm going to have to think that thing through. Because then are you taking the soul and the spirit along with the mind and the heart? I don't know. But we're not there technically yet, so I haven't had to sort that one out. But I can't think of another organ I'd have a problem with. Okay? Real short, Clifford.
Some of the things that we've been talking about can be helped. You use your body as an electrochemical, mechanical device, much like a machine that carries and functions for your spirit. Then it becomes easier, I believe, to understand it's the difference between destroying the body and destroying the spirit.
Okay. God expects us to take as good a care of our body as we can while our spirit and soul are within it. Once our spirit and soul depart from it, it's just not of any value to anybody, including God.
Well, that's where you talk about the brain. If that brain's better, then you're not going to transfer your soul to spirit. I don't need that brain to God would take care of that part.
Okay, that may be right. I'm just not quite to a conclusion in my thinking on that one yet. Margaret, and then I want to move on. Sure. After church? Can you stay a little after class, Margaret? Okay. We'll give you a note if Greg needs one.
I don't want somebody else to pray.
Good. I don't think anyone would want mine. Okay. No one that knows us would want our brains, would they?
No.
Isn't that how it goes? It's just interesting fodder to think on. That's all it was. Thou shalt not commit adultery. I believe this is prohibited also because it defies God. God said in Genesis 1:27, one man, one woman, one flesh in Genesis 2. 1 Corinthians 6 talks about the body being the temple of God. I believe it's wrong for several reasons, but at the top of my list, it's my conclusion, it's wrong because it defies an ordinance of God. When you think about it, all you and I have that's going to last are relationships. Our relationship with God, our relationship with fellow men, and our relationship with our family. And if you live your life and don't have those three things, then you've got nothing left. And when you die, that's all people are going to remember are the relationships. And I think he's trying to protect one of the key relationships here as it relates to marriage. It's interesting, as you go through the Old Testament, you see cases of polygamy, which I don't believe God was ever in favor of, but I do believe he tolerated it for various reasons. But every time I find a polygamous relationship in the Old Testament, it exuded stress and difficulty on the family. Hannah, she was the wife in a polygamous relationship. Great stress there. David, great stress. I mean, his kids were just disasters would be the word I would use for it. Polygamy. But today, it's interesting to me, our society doesn't go for polygamy. We go for what I call serial monogamy. And that's where you have not numerous partners at once, but over the course of your life, you have numerous partners in a series of monogamous relationships. And I would submit to you that that's probably as, if not more, deleterious to the family unit than the concept of monogamy. Polygamy, excuse me, get that out. But God's people are called to a higher standard. I believe marriage was given to us for a variety of reasons, and I've tried to capture them in these four bullets. I won't say that I've captured them all, but I do believe marriage was given to us for procreation. It was given to us for companionship. It was given to us for physical fulfillment. And it was also given to us for spiritual fulfillment. And if you ever want to read some of the most touching and also some of the most explicit love songs and love scenes, go back and read the Song of Solomon. It's a book we tend not to read very often. But it is very explicit in the beauty of the man and the woman relationship. If some of you picked up the Song of Solomon in modern English and didn't know what it was, you would think it was an R-rated book. But it's a beautiful description of the fulfillment, physically and emotionally, of a man. But I believe this particular commandment, thou shalt not commit adultery, and maybe in a little broader scope, the whole marriage concept, is one of the great targets of Satan against the world and also against the church. There's a movie out. I haven't seen it. Don't intend to see it. But it's I've seen the advertisements on TV. Indecent Proposal. Is that right? It's about, and the premise of this, if I understand it, is a guy offers another couple $1 million for the right to spend a night with that man's wife, and brings up this great theological and social issue of would you do it? Well, I hope you've got something better to think about with your time than that. But I think it kind of betrays the mindset of our society, where it's not a matter of is it wrong, it's how much money does it take you to be willing to do it. In some cases, this is kind of a touchy subject because it affects us all. There's not a family here that hasn't been touched by something that relates to this, and that includes me. It includes my family. So I come to you not pointing fingers. I simply think it is something that we have to discuss, and we certainly have to instill upon our young people. You got to first instill it by example, and then you've got to instill it by teaching. Too many people enter into marriage with the concept that it's a disposable institution. Margaret Mead, who was a great sociologist back during the 60s, made that statement, and I'll never forget it. She's now dead. And she said, the problem with marriage is most people enter into it with the concept that it's disposable. And if it doesn't suit them, they'll simply throw it away and get another one. Mark?
This to be fruitful and multiply and replenish here.
Yeah.
Pretty well replenished.
Oh, I don't know about that. When I was 20, people were telling me you shouldn't have kids because the earth's got too many people already. We had kids and there's still room for more. Well, I think you just read it.
Well, but yeah, it is in the context of these people, the circumstances.
There are other passages in the prophets, and I'd have to look it up, and I'll be happy to give it to you. There are other passages in some of the minor prophets, if I recall right, that do seem to indicate that God expects His people to procreate. Now, if you're asking me, is it a sin not to procreate? To me, I'm going to have to give you my opinion. A healthy marriage is going to want a family. Now, that whether that's through adoption or through physical procreation, I think there's lots of options. But there are passages that I believe indicate that that's God's design. I won't say that it's so strongly said that it comes out as a sin if you don't, but I do think it comes out strongly. I'll be happy to get that passage for you if you'd like for me to. And I'm not trying to be judgmental. When I talk to couples that don't want to have kids, my first question is why? And many times, no, I won't say always, many times the answer to that question is a selfish answer. And that's where it breaks down for me. If the reason for not having a family is a selfish answer, then I have trouble right then with the motive. There could be health reasons. If I lived in Somalia, maybe the best thing I could do would be not have more kids because they can't take care of them and so forth. I think that depends with the couple and their ability to raise and handle. I don't think it's a numerical answer. I think it's a capacity answer. Most parents would say one less than they've got. I don't know if you heard me. I think most parents would say being fruitful is one less than they've got. It's interesting. It's been said that commandment back in Genesis 1, to be fruitful and multiply, is the only commandment God ever gave man that man hasn't broke. I had a hand over here. Did it go away, Jerry?
Well, no, I was thinking the old adage of a house is just a house until you have flowers around it. The other one came out, a house is just a house until you have kids.
Yeah, there's lots of cliches. Hey, having a family is serious business, and I'm not advocating entering into it lightly or entering into it when you don't want them. But when people say they don't want them, then I want to go a next step and ask, why don't you want them? That's what I'm saying. And I usually don't get what for me is a fulfilling answer to that question. Man, it's nice to be able to go home and leave all. Okay, adultery destroys the spiritual and emotional aspects of that unity that God intended for a man and a woman to have a spiritual and an emotional experience. And adultery simply devastates that. It's probably the most singly devastating thing to a marriage. I mean, lying's not good in a marriage. Cheating financially's not good. Arguing's not good. Fighting's not good. But this is the one that really, really destroys that unity, because that unity is cemented with the physical relationship. Realize it or not, I believe that's true. And it's so sacred that God adhered that adultery was a capital offense. So that, for me, gives me some indication of how strongly God feels about this. Lots of things weren't, but this is right up there with murder. This is right up there with killing. In order to have a good marriage, it takes a lot of things, but I just listed four things that are important to me. Severance. The two shall leave their father and mother and cleave together. Parents, let them go. Let them go. If you don't, you'll regret it eventually. Let them go. A permanent cleaving. This gets back to the concept, well, if this marriage doesn't work out, we'll just start a new one. It's almost, to me, like marriage for many people today is like going steady used to be when I was in high school. And if you didn't like it, you just get the ring back and start over. But I would submit to you, this is a little more serious. I know you know that. We've just got to make sure our children understand that. And unity and commitment. I put these last two down here, the world's great lies, and I would not have put that if this was not an adult class. But I believe two of the great lies, the one for men, is that there's somewhere out there some super sexual experience, and you got to go hunt it. And men go chasing it. And for women, there's some feeling that there's a perfect marriage out there, and there's a Walton's Mountain, if you'll allow me to use that phrase, and they got to find it. My marriage is not perfect. I know it's not perfect because in order for it to be perfect, I would have to be perfect. and I'm not. My wife doesn't happen to be either, but she may be closer than I. That's irrelevant. Your marriage is not perfect because you're not perfect. Understand that. God tells the husband to love his wife. Men, that's not a suggestion. That's a commandment. And if you don't love your wife, you are, in the ultimate sense, defying God.